The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Joanne Woods, Library Supervisor of the Andorra Branch and founder of the Free Library's Birding Backpack Program. Birding backpacks containing binoculars, field guides, and trail maps, local trail maps, are available at 20 library locations citywide. The Free Library loves birding and fosters environmental stewardship by loaning out birding backpacks and by presenting engaging programs like this one. Amy Tan is the author of many beloved novels, including The Joy Luck Club, for which she also co-wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation, The Kitchen God's Wife, and Valley of Amazement, to name a few. Her prolific body of work also includes the memoir Where the Past Begins, works of nonfiction and children's books. Amy Tan is a conservationist, a birder, and a highly talented artist. In the Backyard Bird Chronicles, she shares her emotional and deeply personal experience relating to individual birds as she ponders the intelligence of corvids, gives a play-by-play of feeder fights, conveys with humor the reasoning of birds, and somberly expresses the obstacles they must overcome to survive. Her bird portraits not only capture the essence of each individual, but I believe also capture her personal response to them as they stare at her. Amy Tan will be joined tonight by Beth Kephart, award-winning author of more than 30 books across a wide range of genres, and these works include Handling the Truth, A Slant of Sun, Love, An Ode to All Things Philly, and Wife, Daughter, Self. Her latest book is an illustrated memoir, My Life in Paper. I'm so excited to be here tonight, and it is my honor and my pleasure to welcome to the stage Amy Tan and Beth Kephart.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here. Thank you. Wanted to tell you a bit about why I got into birds and doing this book. In 2016, there was a change in the atmosphere of our country, and there was a lot of racism that was thrown around in a way that I had never experienced before. And I felt very vulnerable. I felt that the actions were violent in a way. And it made me despair for a while, and I knew that I had to do something that would get me out of that place in my head. And it occurred to me that I would go into nature, because that was a place that I'd always loved as a child, and I hadn't really allowed myself back in that in a concentrated way. So I started nature journaling and learning to draw, and pretty soon the birds took over. I thought about this later, that it was almost as though the hatred of diversity was balanced by the love of biodiversity. I first want to give you an idea of something about the backyard, what we're talking about when I say backyard. And let me see. I think I'm missing some slides here. So you just have to imagine this is a woodland setting. It has oak trees, and portions of the garden have flowering succulents. And this is a habitat for many kinds of birds. And I would learn how many kinds of birds over time. At first, when I started looking at them, there was just a crow and what I called the bluebird, which wasn't a bluebird. It was really a scrub jay. And a hummingbird. I didn't know what kind. I'm just showing you a few slides of the kind of birds that are in my yard. To date, there's 66 species that have visited, and the last one was a very unlikely bird. It was a great blue heron. It was sitting on top of the roof, didn't actually come down and try to eat anything. But anyway, so here's the backyard. And you see these oak trees, and you see there's a green roof. I often think of this green roof as a sign for a lot of birds that are in migration coming to the yard, and they see this green expanse on top, and it says, Amy's Bistro, turn left. Okay, so you saw some of the birds that are in my yard. Anyway, there's a number of birds in there, and as you can imagine, every time I saw a new bird, I would just have this excitement, this unbelievability that went through me seeing a new bird each time. And I didn't know the names of these birds. I would just start drawing these birds, and sometimes I would learn afterwards, after I drew them, what they were. But instead of just identifying the birds as I might have in the past, I was noticing what they were doing. I was noticing their behavior, and that's what I began to write down. This is part of the nature journaling class that I was with. There's this California scrub jay, and it is a fledgling. It's brand new. It's learning how to feed. Hannah's hummingbird, it has that classic male red head when reflected by the light. A very young fledgling dark-eyed junco, which you do have on the East Coast, and a great horned owl, which you also have here. And I just want you to consider looking at this and see what you think is in common with all these birds. What do they have in common? They're all looking at me. And when I saw this the first time, I was so struck because these birds would be feeding or washing or something, and then they would look up, they would see me, and then they would go back to what they were doing. And right then I felt as though I had been accepted as part of their world. I wasn't a friend, they didn't trust me necessarily, but they accepted that I was there as part of their world, and they were part of mine. Eventually, what I started to do was draw these birds. The order of this is a little bit out of sequence because I was going to show you what the birds look like when I first started drawing. And they're very sketchy and very rough. And eventually, doing thousands of hours of practice, I eventually reached this point where I would draw the birds in a very meditative fashion. The teacher I had, John Muir Laws, gave me this hint that what I should do is to feel the bird. And being a fiction writer, I took that one step farther, which is to become the bird. And to imagine I was this bird, and what would I have to know and do and eat, and what kind of predators I should be aware of. And that is what I thought about as I was doing each of the strokes for these birds. One of my first spark birds was a little fluffy pine siskin sitting on the feeder. And I thought it was a baby bird because it was so fluffy. It seemed kind of tired and sleepy. I thought it had been working so hard flying, you know, to migrate or something. But I realized it was December, and you do not have baby birds out in December. The bird flew to me and landed on my arm, and I thought, this is a sick bird. This was a bird that actually had a disease called salmonellosis. I found out there was an outbreak. I took my feeders down, and I was so crushed, I didn't think I'd ever do this again. There's another bird in a picture here. It's a hummingbird, and that was another one of my spark birds. Spark means how you fell in love with these birds. So the hummingbird, I didn't think it would come to me, but it came so quickly to my hand and started feeding, and I would look at the top of the head, and I would talk to this hummingbird and say, you're so brave, you're so beautiful. And it would look up to me and then go back to feeding. So that bird made me fall in love with him. The other bird, the pine siskin, made me think I would never do this again. But as a result of that bird, I got into bird conservation. Every single life is sacred, and I would want to be one of the people there to help save birds. A lot of the books are not about art, about fine art or anything like that. It really is about the behavior of these birds that I'm noticing. So here you have a number of you know, fledglings that are learning. Here you have a number of crows. It's called A Murder of Crow. I had too many of them coming to the feeder, and so I did a very nasty thing. I didn't kill them, but I killed one bird by buying a dead fake crow at the Birds Unlimited store, $14. I messed up the feathers, hung it upside down, and soon I had, 40 crows screaming from all directions to mourn this fake bird. And I had read that they recognize a fallen comrade, but I thought, do they recognize a fake dead bird? But it worked. Soon they didn't come quite as often to the yard. Another behavior that I looked at, how do they sing? What are the, when do they sing? And this one had to do with its movement of its tail. Another one, how do fledglings, these are scrub jays, how do they learn survival skills, meaning how do they learn to hunt and find food, and how do they learn to eat that food? It seems like it would be just instinctual that a baby bird would be able to pick up a seed, tip its head, and then swallow. But that is not the case. These birds have to learn to swallow. The fledglings I saw would pick up the seeds, hold it in their beak, and do this, waiting for it to fall into their throat as it had been, it was pushed down into their throat by their parents. So this is about a scrub jay that was learning and kept falling off the feeder and doing it over and over again, then crying to its mother to be fed to get this. The little sign says, this is the last regurgitation. And then she flew off, and the poor bird had to learn how to break into the feeder. An hour later, after first looking at this baby bird was still doing that, and I think it accounts for the intelligence that corvids had, and that is persistence. I also looked at adaptability. Now, I'm using these quasi-scientific terms. What I was looking at is my stubbornness to believe what I was reading at Cornell Ornithology, which said little ground feeders will never go to a feeder. They just dig in the dirt to find their worms and insects, and they're very secretive. You hardly will see them. So this is a hermit thrush, one of those secret birds that would never go to a feeder. And instead, it landed on this feeder and inspected it for a good 20 minutes and came back repeatedly trying to figure out how to get into it. And eventually it succeeded, and I would always see this bird in the feeders getting worms and such. I was watching birds that were very territorial. They had the same food. This was an artificial situation. You don't always, in the wild, in the trees, these birds are not sitting next to each other feeding. They're in their own areas eating. And with the feeders, I have created a situation where there's interspecies competition for the food. So I got to watch the behavior and whether it was different with a member of its own kind versus a new kind of bird. What were the factors that influence who got the food? And it turned out it's not necessarily just size. There would be tiny birds near a bigger bird, and the strategy goes like this. You fly down very surreptitiously and you land right behind the other bird, and by instinct the bird leaps up and leaves, and the little bird would get the food and take off. Little birds are very smart too. I saw that there were birds who were shapeshifters. This was a California towhee who wasn't able to get into the hand-built cages that I made, and I made them especially to keep out the larger birds like the scrub jays, the crows, the squirrels. And this bird tried all the angles. You get to see how birds think and adapt and look. This bird went to all different sides, and then it saw a white-throated sparrow, which you have here on the East Coast. And it went in easily, took a seed, and came out. And this bird that was a lot bigger suddenly was able to change its shape magically, jump in and jump out. I don't know how it did it, but this is part of the magic of birds. Anyway, I have a number of these, and they're in the book, which you can look at later. The role that birds have played in my life, especially in, for example, times of grief, where friends had died, and I had seen something very special I'd never seen before in the yard, and it caused me to wonder whether it was my friend who had come back, but also knowing that there's a lot of, birds are a lot about hope in grief. And they do serve that purpose, whether it's true or not, that friend, loved ones have come back and that. I'm just going to leave you with one last very important scientific study that I did on owls. And we had two owls in our tree that it was astonishing because I had only seen owls a few times out in the wild, and it usually be just this tiny glimpse of them up against a tree trunk. One day I had two owls, a mother and her son, a baby, a juvenile, that was learning how to hunt in our yard. And it was very exciting. I thought they'd only be there for a few hours, but they in fact stayed, the mother from July until October and her son until the spring in April. Later he came back and he brought his girlfriend and they stayed for a while and did a little courtship, and then they took off to go find a place to nest. Anyway, when I looked up at the owl, I thought, this is the face I always see. It was either a sleeping face or the eyes were open looking at me. And so the first picture, of course, is the resting face. When he's relaxed, that is what he looks like. And then, you know, when he's courting, he had his sexy face. And then his happy face, of course. And then his mother love face when he's looking at his mom. And the hangry face, which was often. And then, of course, the attack human face. Many have been grateful to me for documenting that so they know when to be careful and get out of the way. I don't want to say too much more about the book because I want to have this conversation with Beth. So I'm going to close right there with the slides, and let's move to the second part. Thank you.
What an honor it is to meet you and also to experience you. We had some time before this began, and who would not love you, Amy Tan? Who would not?
The squirrels.
Well, yes. We have some questions. Your book, The Joy Luck Club, which I reread a week ago, and boy, it's just as powerful now as it always was, begins. The old woman remembered a swan she had bought many years ago in Shanghai for a foolish sum. That's how it begins. That woman and that swan had sailed together toward America, but at immigration, the woman's swan was taken from her, leaving the woman with a single feather that she hoped to someday give her daughter, a bird and a feather. They launched your first novel, launched in many ways your life of stories, and yet it wasn't until you and Lou built this beautiful home in Sausalito that birds became your nearly daily companions. What made you and what makes us ready to have birds in our lives?
Well, birds are everywhere, and like me, many people probably haven't noticed how many birds are out there and how many different kinds of birds. And I would wager that most people who are out in the wild and see birds feel a kind of wonder and calm. And this is something that it's accessible, and we just don't think about doing it deliberately. Oftentimes it's accidental. We happen to go to a park. I think that so much in my life, as you brought up with reading this passage about the feather, so much in my life I have found is unintentional. And it's an opportunity that I've taken. So the feather story, somebody said I made this up, but it was actually a saying that my uncle had in China. He gave me a gift, and is as apology, as humble offering, he said, this feather may look worthless, but it comes from afar and carries all my good intentions. And I thought, this is so much about what's gone in my life with many things, that they have come with a lot of hardship and work, and then you get this gift and you don't know exactly what it is, but it comes with all its good intentions. And I think of birds in that way, a single feather, but the beauty of that, all the good intentions that are out there that we can take advantage of.
The fact that birds show up so much in art, from Egyptian time to Sigrid Nunes and her parrot to Hitchcock, to so many artists who turn to birds, what is it in the end that is the art of a bird that makes birds for us want to become, want to integrate those birds into our art?
birds, I think they've occupied everything from religion to artistic beauty to symbolism of, you know, our American eagle. All of those are part of every aspect of our life in a way. And just that these birds in art also capture what is so wondrous about birds. I think of birds as being miraculous in a way, because if you look at them, if you look at an adult bird, you have to realize that this bird is one of very few that made it to adulthood. About 75% of them die before they ever become an adult. And of that, 40% of those die in the first 3 weeks. So you have this great mortality, and it's the nature of things, the balance of things. But if you have more die than usual, then you have these birds that are become endangered. Anyway, when you look at a bird, just think of that miracle of who they are, what they've endured. Even though they can fly and go places, there's a certain fragility to them that is often not captured in our art. We see the beauty of them. We see the fact that they have wings and they can fly and they represent freedom. But I think often we don't see them in the art as birds that are possibly going to die.
That is so true. I mean, I was thinking about Emily Dickinson and all of her bird work, but that is, you have made me think, I'm going to look at books in a new way now and art in a new way when birds appear. So the birds in your life don't just appear, they are invited. You whistle bird song. You offer a buffet of suet and seeds. There are water baths. You build these. I was wondering how you build these feeders. You hold out your hand, as the image just showed, and put a small dish of nectar there, and a hummingbird arrives, looks up, looks down. You sprinkle seeds on your window. And yet you write on page 126, "I cannot command them to come. So when they do visit, I feel hope enough to override the dread I sometimes feel for what may be coming for planet Earth." So the question is, are there still days when you wonder if any birds will come, and will it always be a surprise when you find them?
I never take it for granted that they're going to come, that they're going to be there, any one single bird. It might be that the hummingbirds disappear, which they have. They're always gone for about a month every year, and I always fear they're never going to come back. I have no control over it. But then, in a way, that's part of the beauty of it. When we go out into the wild, the fact that we can't expect that a certain kind of beauty will be there is what adds to how much we appreciate being there, the surprise of it. The birds do leave. I've just had a whole species of birds leave because it's migration time. And they were the most numerous birds in my yard, the golden-crowned sparrows, which you don't have here. They come from Canada and Alaska, and they make that several thousand-mile trek back. And you wonder how these tiny little birds can do that. But they left my yard after they had become quite striking with their adult breeding plumage, these black brows, this yellow, neon yellow crown, and then they leave. So when I came back, I had to go away for a while. I came back, they were all gone. And that was to be expected in a way. And yet, I feel a kind of mourning when they're not there. I do think always that they will come back, in part because I provided a menu, a bistro, that is unlike any other place. I have these feeders, these feeder cages that I made, and they're a grid pattern. I lace them together, I hang them up, and I put really excellent food in there, like live mealworms. And this is absolutely the haute cuisine of the bird world. I have to tell you as an aside that I have gotten a little obsessive about birds, and that, you know, when you're making your own cage feeders and when you are buying a variety of organic, non-GMO foods and their different spice levels, you're kind of tilting toward pathology. But the live mealworms was the biggie, because when they come, they are all wiggly and they're still alive, and they come in a big bag, and I have to actually stick my hand in there and put them in containers, and you can feel the life of them moving. And I'm just saying, I'm sorry. I think they know they're not going to, you know, grow up to be beetles. They're not really worms. They're larvae. And I have to put them in the fridge so they don't advance in their development into beetles. And so my husband's very, very understanding. I mean, how many of you have partners who wouldn't mind seeing 20,000 live mealworms in the refrigerator?
But anyway. Don't you have a second refrigerator now?
I now have a second refrigerator, yeah. Yeah, I had to. I mean, he said, you're getting out of control here. We have to get a second refrigerator. Not only that, but I have dead birds in the freezer. People will bring me dead birds, or occasionally I find, very sadly, a bird that has died. And I put them in the freezer to later bring them to California Academy of Sciences, which will take them. I'm sorry, I've gone veered off course here, and I can't remember. The ephemeral nature of birds is what we're all concerned about, especially in conservation. And, in fact, they are like the canary in the mine. You know, they are a signal of things that are happening in our environment. So when you have a great loss of birds, it often has to do with the environment. The loss of habitat, changes in habitat, often are bad for our environment, for the balance of our environment. Anyway, there is actually one very famous bird that just went extinct, and it is the bluebird. It's called Elon's bluebird. Oh. And we won't have to have the Ornithological Society rename this bird just because a lot of people don't like Elon Musk. Elon's bluebird has become extinct, meaning it's become X. Yeah, I know, a birder joke. Okay, you heard it here.
Who knew that Elon was going to show up tonight?
I actually sent that to David Sibley today. If you know your bird guidebooks, David Sibley is, you know, he's to birds what Webster's is to words. I sent that, and he said, thank you for explaining to me.
I want to talk about, we were talking earlier, about Isabella Stewart Gardner, who famously went around the world just, I want that, and it will go into the gorgeous museum.
Yeah.
And sculptures, tapestries, books, they are placed in her museum, they're never to be moved, you know. But here, you are the opposite. You've created a space into which and from which these flying things come. I wondered if there are lessons about possession and non-possession as a bird watcher in this backyard that you've crafted.
Well, for me, I never think of these as birds that belong to me. I may call mm-hmm. them my birds because I see them and they're in my yard. But what I love about them is the fact that they're wild, not my pets. So I don't name them. The only birds I have named are the owls, and that was because we always had two of them. And we would, my husband and I, in the morning, we would always say, are Junior and Mom there? Or sometimes it would be Junior's there, Mom is not. And we needed names for them. And the names then were based only on their relationship to each other. So there's that they don't belong to me. And in the bird world, there is something that has to do with territory and whether this part of the tree belongs to this bird or does this food belong to another. And you get to see that worked out if you just watch it for a long time, how they sort this out, who gets what kind of food. There is also territory regarding water. Now, all this boils down to not just gathering possessions just for, like, you know, for a museum. It has to do with their gathering things twigs for a nest or whatever. It's always for the purpose of survival. And that is what, you know, dominates everything that I see now. I just used to see these as separate behaviors, but now I have an overall look at why these things happen.
So I have a question for you. You do name a certain, there's a Fagin in your
there's
book.
There's a Fagin.
So what does that
who's
say about
rat.
Possession? Yes. So what does that mean? Yeah, do you possess
yeah.
the rat?
Well, I was looking at one point, thinking about mortality of birds and who were the biggest culprits of you know, the death of birds. So rats, they steal the food, and it doesn't matter. You can get the extra hot pepper suet, the Sichuan pepper, and it doesn't matter to them. There was this one time I really went kind of all out to get back at the rats, and this is terrible. Don't report me to the Society Against Cruelty to Animals, but I didn't kill the rats, but I took this hot pepper suet that I bought, and then I added a little extra ghost pepper to it. And I put it in a cage that was hanging. It had a swinging bowl in it. And I set this over a tall planter that was empty and had curving sides, so it was very slippery. And the rat would have to be very persistent to jump onto this, planter and go into the cage and balance on it and reach that swinging bowl, which would probably cause it to fall into this deep planter. It could get out eventually, but it would, you know, they're kind of neophobic, so maybe they would keep away. And then what I thought, you know, I saw them looking at it. There was a mother rat, two baby rats on the side. They were taking lessons on thievery from the mother. And I watched this, and the rat just, it was going to give up. And I thought, yay, Amy won, rats zero. But then all of a sudden, the rat jumped up, grabbed this thing, the bowl is swinging, she had a big thing of suet like this, and she dropped it, and she bit into it, and then suddenly, she was like a customer in a Japanese restaurant who'd never had wasabi and puts a dollop of it in her mouth. And she just shot up, I swear. She was like the cartoon Wile E. Coyote, shot up, ran to the rock wall and climbed up the vines, the jasmine. And then I thought, okay, we're done. They'll never do that again. She came down and then she took the rest of the suet with her and her babies followed. So she came back over and over again for that suit, proving how adaptable rats are and why they are so successful in this world. And you have to apply that to birds as well, that the birds that are very adaptable, that will eat any kind of food and be almost in any kind of environment, like the house sparrow or the starling, both birds that are not native here, that they have this huge chance of surviving, although we don't know why the house sparrows are not surviving in Europe. And that birds that are very specialized, like our little oak titmouse, that oak tree belongs to them, but we're having more oak trees removed for land development, and as a result, their population decreases in direct result to that.
I'm watching a novelist at work. All those verbs, as you told the rat story, were quite impressive.
The rat story.
That was good.
I'm a novelist, you can tell, because I just go on these different digressions. And then I have my editor here, Dan Halpern, whose idea, this book was his idea to do. My thing was just this messy journal, these 9 volumes of these sketches and these notes on bird behavior, and he is the one who said, why don't we do a book of these? And I said, no, this is not what you think. This is a big mess, and it has smudges and misspellings, and the birds, you know, the drawings are very crude. They're not at all artistic. And he said, no, I think that's what we want. So, okay, so that's what we have here.
I think it's much more than that. In fact, I'm going to skip ahead to talk, since you're talking about that, about the arc of the book. Yeah. Now, it did come from 9 journals. You compressed, sometimes we were talking earlier, you would erase a little so that we could see even neater handwriting around your images. But for me, the arc of the book, and I know there's a secondary to this that you were talking about backstage, I saw it as the art of learning to see, and then the middle section was learning to know, and then committing to wonder and awe. And you said that there was another driving factor. Maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong, but there was something else that was driving your work.
Well, I think that what I have when I look at birds is a regained sense of childhood wonder and curiosity. And that started in the beginning, but I didn't know very much about birds. And that was good because my curiosity was completely open. If you don't know something, you can either shut down and not bother to go any further with that. But if you want to learn what's going on, these stories that are unfolding, then by looking at the behavior and asking questions, you can discover a little bit more. I'm still not an expert on birds. There's so much that I ask questions about, and I never feel that I will find the exact answers. Sometimes I ask ornithologists, and it's very refreshing when they say, gosh, I have no idea. You know, they too have a lot to know. But as you said, there is this arc, and it has to do with my naivete growing in sprouting in different directions of interest. I have some knowledge. I no longer look at a bird and say, what's that bird? I know a lot of the birds and who they are and where they come from, what they eat. And it goes into much more reflection, I think, later, almost a philosophical reflection sometimes. There was one time when I saw the yellow jackets that were keeping the birds from coming to the food. They were just around the mealworms. The yellow jackets would sit on the mealworms and start eating them live. Wow. Of course, they're always eaten live because, you know, that's the purpose. But these, I just felt the agony of the mealworms. This is me. This is the novelist also being the bird, but also being the mealworm. And so the yellow jackets were, you know, keeping away the birds. So I got a yellow jacket trap, which you put a little sugar in there, some dog food, some other things. And I set that up, and the yellow jackets went in there, and they were buzzing around. And then some of them could not, they were trying to get out. And you could see this distress, and other yellow jackets would come. And then it seemed like the ones inside said something to them, like, run, take, you know, run for your lives, don't come in here, or whatever it was. I was imagining this, because they all took off. And it was like, I read something later that yellow jackets can actually recognize each other. So then I'm thinking, it's like, Betty, just be patient, we'll come get you soon, you know. And then later it's, Al, take off, they're going to kill you as well. So I would have these things in my mind as I'm watching this. I don't know, is that crazy? I'm watching this, but then I started to feel sorry for the yellow jackets. So I felt sorry for the bird, then sorry for the mealworms, and sorry for the yellow jackets. And I kept hearing this phrase on Facebook. Whenever somebody showed a bird that had been killed by something, they'd say, oh, circle of life. And I thought, I hate that phrase, because when they say that, it's mostly like saying we don't need to grieve the death of these creatures. We don't have to think about any of their agony, of their pain, or their fear. Circle of life. And I think that for me, I asked myself, just because they're in a certain hierarchy in our food chain, does that mean I should care about these other creatures less than the birds? Mm. Well, the birds are cuter, of course. But no, I have to think about the lives of other creatures as well. So again, I have diverted from your question. I no longer remember what you're asking. But
I'm here to present your beautiful mind and book. So wherever you go is fine. Is this generational, the love of birds? And you were telling me earlier about your next-door neighbor and this Fiona. And if we could close talking about stewardship.
Yeah.
And who Fiona is in your life, and how you hope birds will be loved 10, 15, 20 years from now.
There are three young people who are in my life in this journey with birds, this life journey with birds. Two of them are children who live next door. They're the children of my goddaughter. And one of them takes care of the feeders when I'm gone, and I'm gone a lot. So it's his job to refill the feeders every day and also to clean those water bowls every day so that there's fresh water. That's not mine, I don't think. And the little girl, she's six, and she goes with us into the yard, and we find owl pellets, and she finds feathers, and she safeguards them. And I tell her there's a law that you can't keep these feathers, but you can protect them. I say, you know, you don't own them, you can protect them. And so they are growing up with this sense of nature and how fragile it is, but how beautiful it is as well. The other is a young woman. She's now a young woman named Fiona. And when I first met her, she was 13. I was on a Nature Journal field trip, you know, learning to draw what was in front of me and ask questions. So I was so new. I was trying to draw a beautiful picture of something, and it wasn't working. But I look over and I see Fiona. She's got question marks all over, like actual questions. And she has this scrawl, and it's going in different directions like this. And she's asking her mother and John Muir Laws, our teacher, our guide, our guru, you know, one question. Well, I wonder why, you know, the blah, blah, blah. One question after the other. And I said, oh, God, get away from this girl. She is trouble. You know, endless questions. Very annoying. And then later I discovered very quickly the whole purpose of being there is to ask questions. Because when you have the mind of a child, you don't have assumptions that shut off what you're actually seeing. And so in the future field trips, I would find Fiona and I would stand next to her, and like a person cheating on a math exam, I would look over to see what questions she had. And after that, she became my mentor, and to this day she is. She's in college now, Mount Holyoke, but we get together a lot. In the old days, we would anything together, a feather we found. My editor and I saw a dead bird today on the street. I said, well, Fiona was here. We would pick up that bird and we'd examine every single part of it to identify this bird and what possibly had killed it, and then do something that would enable us to sanctify and, you know, put this bird somewhere together. So I think it's fitting that the person who has influenced me the most possibly in my learning about birds was a child, now a young woman.
That's a beautiful place to end. And thank you so much for coming to Philadelphia, for bringing your beauty here.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you.
And questions.
How many here look at birds, go birding, bird watching? Oh, there's quite a few of you. Great.
So thanks for being
here.
Thank you. I know you recently went to Ecuador, and I would just love to hear anything about your trip to Ecuador and nature journaling there. Thank you.
First, if God created the world and including birds, I think he got drunk when he was creating birds in Ecuador, because the colors are so fantastical. They're unreal, and the shapes of them and everything about them are astonishing. When I was in Ecuador in January, first, the landscape is stunning. But we saw, I was with the American Bird Conservancy, I'm on their board, and we had experts. We had a number of experts in the second half. One of them actually is Jonathan Franzen, who's an author, really
yes.
great author, but he's an excellent birder, and we're yeah. friends. But I found that, you know, after looking at 500 birds, that is really not the kind of birding that I like to do, because you're looking at one bird at a time, and they're calling out the names of these birds, and I can barely keep up. I can't see them. They're maybe 300 yards away. They see a spot of color, and they say, "Lacrimose tanager," you know, and I'm going, "What? What did you say?" You know, and you can't say that too often when people are just going like this, one bird after the other. And then you see them in the scope. What I like to do is sit in one place and just look at one bird or, you know, two birds or whatever, all day long, the same birds. I don't need to see a lot of different birds. It was a great experience, but I would much rather stick to bird watching.
Okay, so my husband and I have, I introduced him to bird watching in our backyard, and I spend a lot of time in nature because I have horses and I ride every day, and I watch horses the way you watch birds. But my question is, he got annoyed with certain birds that he thought were sort of trash birds, like the starlings and some other, I know, which I love watching because they're so much fun when they bathe, among other things, and their songs are beautiful. So he bought food with pepper in it, like it's a, and the, because of a rat problem, they're, you know, like bell-shaped, yeah. You know what I'm talking
yeah.
about, right?
I buy that, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but it seems to me that many birds don't like that, and we have fewer birds and fewer variety. I want to know what your experience was.
Huh. I haven't found the birds are fewer with the food that I give them, but that's because they do specifically buy foods for all the different species. I don't think of any bird as being a trash bird. Every single bird is a good bird. I mean, I'm just so grateful to see them. It could be the most ordinary house sparrow, house finch, you know. They're all beautiful, miraculous in their way. So I just, you know, I'm happy to welcome all of them and, you know, and learn something new about each of them every day.
Hi, thank you for coming to Philadelphia. I've been reading your books since I am from Venezuela, since I live in my country of origin. They get there even in Spanish, and they resonate with us there too, so I think that's wonderful. My question is, I don't know if you, and this might be a digression on my part, I don't know if you watch the new Ghibli movie, it's called The Boy and the Heron, and it's a lot about grief and about birds too. I was just, because you mentioned that one of the birds that stay at your house, or that went to your house, the weirdest one was a blue-gray heron. Mm. So it really kind of like, but it also made me think, I haven't read the book, but about kind of like the quality of your drawings sometimes looks very hyper-realistic, and sometimes it's kind of like goofing around, almost cartoonish.
Yeah.
And
you
I
should
also
have seen the even earlier ones. Yeah.
And it also made me think about your writing and how sometimes your writing is, it feels so hyper-realistic, and sometimes me being a Latin American, I associated to almost like magical realism. So I was wondering if you feel any of that process was going on when you were drawing birds, and that you would drift, if it was a very like free process or
yeah.
more structured process.
That's exactly right. It was a very free process, and part because I didn't ever think of this as a book that would be published. So I wasn't needing to shape a book that would satisfy a certain art in making a book. It was a daily habit in looking at birds and writing up a drama, what the drama was. It could just be two birds fighting over territory in a bowl of water, for example, or a sick bird, or a bird that was courting another one. I would write these things, and sometimes they would be very rough sketches of just the picture of the bird itself. Sometimes it was the action that was going on. The very finished drawings that you saw here, those were more meditations, and those were never supposed to represent behavior, but they are the individuals that I looked at. All of the birds that I drew were ones that looked at me, and they were only birds from my yard. So I haven't seen the movie you're talking about, but it was a thrill, for example, to see a great blue heron in my yard. I didn't see it do any other kind of behavior except standing on the roof and looking down. I've also had a pair of bald eagles fly over. I always count the vertical space. I don't count birds way off in the distance, the pelicans that fly over the bay. I have my own rules, and I think everybody creates their rules for their their backyard birds, what they consider their backyard. And that's the free part of it as well. You can create whatever standards you want for birding, whether you can only count the birds that you recognize or that you hear. There's a Merlin app you can use, and it will identify birds by song in your yard. I use that to give me hints about the birds, but I don't count those birds that I have not yet seen. So we all have our rules about that. That just goes to say there's so much freedom in how you can look at birds and what your relationship is and how you represent that, simply in telling a story about it to somebody else or writing down observations and doing these sketches with conversation bubbles in them.
Hi, Amy.
Hi.
My name is Lindsay. I actually met you about 10 years ago here at the library.
Oh.
I came with my mother. Similar event. And I remember it was really special to me because I'm also a writer. I like to think of myself as a storyteller because I tell stories in many mediums. And it was really special. You wrote to me in my book, Joy and Luck in Your Writing. And I found in these last 10 years since I was last here.
Wonderful.
It's hard to find joy and luck in your writing and to stay persistent and to continue to tell your stories. How do you continue to do that?
Hope is the thing with feathers, as Emily Dickinson wrote. You know, we take hope in many different ways, and it is an agony to write fiction for me in a way, but there's always a point in the fiction where something breaks through, and the feeling of that is such a high that I can't get in anything else. It's like myself, the true self, has cracked open and I can see it for the first time. And then it disappears, but there's the feeling, the sense of it, the truth of what my life is and how I see that, that becomes the driving force for all the disappointments, the agony, the feeling of failure and all of that. I still have that. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, she's a successful writer. It's so easy to write now. It'll all be published. From 1 to 500, it's total agony, and often many of those pages get tossed. So if you understand that it's simply part of the process and that you're always looking for the greater truth of what you're trying to say, what you're trying to represent, and not the contrivance part, the creating of the fiction, can be the impossible architecture that falls apart after a while, just remember, you can keep working on it. And it may take a lot of time, but that also should be part of the discovery of who you are.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.